Is God doing something good behind the scenes in our world, even though we can't always see it? And is God doing something good behind the scenes in your lives, even though you can't always see it? Well, in the Bible, a very important idea is the idea of providence. And here's a definition from one of the magisterial reformers, John Calvin, who says, it's the invisible hand of God. It's a great definition. The invisible hand of God. It's God moving, guiding, directing things behind the scenes, often in ways that we can't see, either generally in the world or even specifically in our lives. Now, providential stories are all over the place in the Bible. One of the most obvious is Joseph. And you find Joseph's story in the book of Genesis. And so Joseph is favored by God. He's also favored by his father. See, he's the youngest of many sons. And his father gives him this multicolored coat, which his brothers don't really like. By the way, favoritism is not a great parenting strategy. The brothers conspire to kill him. They change their mind. They actually sell him to a traitor. So he becomes a slave, and they take him down to Egypt. Meanwhile, they tell his father, who loves him, that he's actually died, and so his own father's heart is broken. Down in Egypt, Joseph is there. He starts his slave work. He is falsely accused. He is put into prison. He languishes there. He helps people. He eventually rises to the second in authority in Egypt. He saves the land from famine. Meanwhile, back up home where his family, brothers and fathers, are the ones who sold him into slavery, they're also having a famine. They have to come down and grovel at this person's feet. They don't know it's Joseph whom they have sold into slavery, but he knows. The drama is played out. Eventually, the plot is revealed. And there's this moment of reconciliation, but they're not sure. Is this guy that we kind of conspired against, is he going to treat us harshly? And now he's this powerful man in the land of Egypt. And Joseph says this, Genesis 50, verse 20, "You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good." You meant evil against me, and God meant it for good. And this is one of the Bible's most obvious stories of providence, the invisible hand of God. But think of all the stuff that happened in the intervening time. Based on my math, it's about 22 years between that initial being sold into slavery and by the time he is reconciled with his brothers. So sold into slavery, his father's broken heart, down into Egypt, he starts his work, falsely accused, sent to prison, eventually rises to prominence, 22 years. Now that isn't to say that everything that happened was good. Drew Poplin has said, God uses sin sinlessly. God uses sin sinlessly. In other words, there is sin in your life and my life and brokenness in the world at large. Even still, God's greatness and his sovereignty is so powerful and wonderful that he can work good things to his good and glorious purposes despite the presence of darkness and of sin. God uses sin sinlessly. So as we approach the birth of Christ, I'm going to invite us to widen our lens a little bit today, for us to back up a little bit, put aside the tinsel and the consumerism and the busy schedules. We're going to take our time for a minute, and we're going to think about God's invisible hand, his providential hand, and the arrival of Christ, perhaps in ways that maybe we haven't really seen before. Sometimes you see signs out there this time of year. They say, you know, born to die that we might live. Born to die that we might live. And being born, that's nice. Dying, that can be sad. Born to die, that seems tragic. Born to die that we might live. Well, that seems very hopeful, but how is God's providential hand? Really, when you get into the difficulty of this story, how do you see that at work? Where is the providence in being born in a filthy manger, no room at the inn, Herod murdering innocent children, fleeing as refugees to Egypt, being rejected, tortured, and crucified? Well, it brings us back to those initial two questions. Is God doing something good behind the scenes in our world, even though that we can't see it? Is God doing something good behind the scenes in our lives individually, even though sometimes we cannot see it? So to unpack the idea, we're going to look at Isaiah 53. Now, when you think of prophets, the prophet Isaiah, you think of prophets in the Bible, you think of, you know, wild men, and they're out in the desert, and they've got like hair shirts or something, and they're, you know, they're wild, their hair is crazy. They're speaking a prophetic word from God. And although that can be true, Isaiah is possibly a little bit different. And so, according to one tradition, Isaiah may have been a cousin to King Uzziah. And part of the reason that matters is because he had this incredible influence. And so, if that is so, then he's also nobility. So, he's being influential, not because he's sharing this authoritative word from God, but because he's kind of one of the upper classes. And so he does this ministry over the course of multiple kings. People are really listening to him. This guy is really influential in and around Jerusalem as well amongst the people of God. And so he prophesies a word from the Lord to these people who are being disobedient. He says they're spiritually deaf and blind in chapter 6. Judgment will come. Many of them will be banished to a faraway land. God will eventually restore the people, and he will do so through a coming servant king. And this coming servant king is talked about a lot in the book. God with us, he is described as in chapters 7 to 9. He will sit on David's throne, Isaiah 16. He will bring justice to the nations, Isaiah 42. So this king is also a servant. Now, we have come to know that this has found fulfillment in Jesus. Now, Isaiah actually did his work in the 8th century BC. That is over 700 years before Christ. But there is so much detailed information about him in this book that many of the church fathers actually called the book of Isaiah the fifth gospel, right? So we know the four gospels, Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, the fifth gospel, because there's so much in here about the coming servant king Christ, even though it was written, comes together over 700 years before Christ. And so as we jump into the text, I want to give two kind of procedural details. The text is going to be in black font, but sometimes there's going to be words in red. And those are the words that I'm going to say something specific about. Also, in the interest of time, as I reference, as prophecies are fulfilled in the New Testament, I will give chapter numbers, but not verses. But if you want the more comprehensive notes, I'm happy to share them with you later. Let's begin. Isaiah 52, verse 13, reading from the ESV. Let's open and explore the divine word of God. Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. So right out of the gate, the ancient prophecy says that the coming king will be a servant. And this is exactly what Jesus says he is. He says in Luke 22, I am among you as one who serves. Plus in John 13, he washes his own disciples' feet, which is an act of servanthood. And then he lays down his life as an act of ransom, Matthew 20. Now it goes on to say that he will act wisely. That's what the ancient prophecy says. And the stories, the gospel stories, are just filled with information about how people are just captivated by the wisdom of Jesus, even from the time when he was a young boy. So you remember that story when he's left back behind in the temple and the teachers are amazed, Luke 2, at his level of understanding, although he's still young. As we go through the Gospels and his adult ministry, the crowds are astonished at his teaching, Luke 4. Third, the ancient prophecy says that the coming king will be high and lifted up. Now, what does that mean? Does it just mean that he's going to be honored, generally speaking? Well, probably. But also, in John chapter 12, Jesus says that he will be lifted up to draw all people to himself, which is actually a reference to him on the cross. He'll be lifted up upon the cross and draw people to himself. And then, in Romans 8, the Apostle Paul that says that he is exalted to the right hand of our Heavenly Father. He is exalted and lifted up in every possible way, and it was all planned 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born. It was all planned. Verse 14, as many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So now the ancient prophecy says that his appearance will be marred, meaning disfigured. Well, we know from John 19 that as a part of Jesus' torture, he was flogged. And so those whips, as we have discussed before, often had pieces of bone or metal or kind of a rudimentary glass at the end of the whips. And it's designed to make the torture worse because it peels skin off of flesh. So it's so horrific that many people, according to historical records, actually died from blood loss before the torture is over. And so no wonder his figure is marred. Even that is all planned. 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you are born, it is all planned. Verse 15, so shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. So the ancient prophecy says that the coming king will sprinkle many nations. What does that mean? Well, based on what we just heard about his horrific torture and blood loss, it may be an allusion to something that happens in Leviticus 4, where the ancient priests, based on the blood of a dead animal, sprinkle the blood which is a sign of forgiveness on the people. So given the blood splatter that surely would have been with Christ on the cross, might this also be an indication of the forgiveness that he will offer to the nations for all people who will come to him? Look at the detail. It was all planned. 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you are born, it is all planned. Continuing, he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. This is absolutely beautiful. Oh, sorry, verse 53, I missed that one. Chapter 53, verse 1. Who has believed what he has heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant and like a root out of dry ground. And so the ancient prophecy here says something, again, which seems kind of strange. He will be a root out of dry ground. Now, at the surface, this seems to be a reference to just some sort of plant or tree. But the idea is that since it comes at a dry ground, it's unimpressive and not very interesting to us, and it's probably not going to survive and have a great legacy, right? And what is Jesus' birthplace? It is Nazareth, even in the Gospels. Can anything good come out of Nazareth? John 1. So this is probably an allusion to the fact that he has these humble, unimpressive beginnings, and this too is planned. Continuing, he had no form or majesty that we should look at him, no beauty that we should desire him. And so the ancient prophecy says that the coming king would have no form or beauty that we should desire him. So the idea here is his looks. This is the only description in the entire Bible that talks about what Jesus looked like, or rather what he didn't look like, right? And so what did Jesus look like? Culturally, historically, he would have had fairly dark skin, tight black hair, would have probably had a black beard, which was the Jewish custom of the day, would have had kind of the robe-type garments, which we've seen in all the pictures, right? But there is nothing impressive about his looks. People didn't follow him because he was attractive or handsome. They followed him because of what he said and what he did. And it was all planned. 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born, it was all planned. Verse 3, he was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, and as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised and we esteemed him not. And so here the ancient prophecy says that this coming king will be despised and rejected. And friends, when it comes to these types of passages, there are almost too many to count. He was rejected by people in his hometown of Nazareth, Luke 4. He was rejected by many in the crowds, John 6. He was rejected by the religious leadership in Jerusalem, Mark 14. He was even rejected by many of his own disciples as he faced death, Mark 14, John 13. The ancient prophecy goes on to say that the coming king will be a man of sorrows. Not only was Jesus sorrowful for himself, but also when his own friends went through hardship and death. Think of Lazarus in John 11. He wept at the death of his friend. The ancient prophecy says the coming king was acquainted with grief. And as we know famously, the night before he was tortured, we are told that his sweat became like drops of blood, Luke 24, an experience that doctors today refer to as hematohidrosis, in moments of incredible distress, and it was all planned. 700 years before Christ was born, and 2,700 years before you were born, it was all planned. Verse 4, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, and we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement, the punishment that brought us peace, and with his wounds we are healed. So the ancient prophecy says that the coming king's punishment will bring our peace, and this is at the very heart of the good news or the gospel of the Christian faith. But how is it that what someone else does can actually be credited to us? I recently heard this story of an ancient king who was at once both perfectly just and perfectly loving. But there was a bit of a controversy in the kingdom. Someone was stealing gold from the royal treasury. And the king, because he's just, he says that whoever did this, will receive 10 lashes. So that was the punishment. So word went out. The next week, more gold is stolen. He says, well, the punishment's going to be worse. It's now 20 lashes. The next week, more gold is stolen, 30 lashes. The next week, more gold even yet is stolen. And he says, this is the ultimate punishment. 40 lashes, which everyone knew was the equivalent of the death penalty. People are wondering what's going to go on. But then all of a sudden, controversy of controversies, it was discovered that the thief was none other than the king's own daughter. And so it's revealed, and people are like, what's the king going to do? And he says, well, the punishment needs to happen. And so on the day of the punishment, she comes out. She comes up on the platform. Everyone is gathered. The back of her dress is ripped open, so she leans over this table, and the punisher is there with the whips, and he goes to raise up the whips. And just before he does so, the king yells out, stop! And he pauses, and everyone looks at him, what's going to do? So he gets up on the platform. He rips off his own shirt. He puts himself over his daughter. And he looks back to the punisher and he says, begin. The punisher's like, king, I can't do it. You're the king. He says, I'm the king. Do what I tell you. And so he leans over his daughter, protecting her. And he starts with the lashing. 1, 2, all 40. And the king dies. The king dies, but the daughter, with tears going down her face, she goes free. And this, and all illustrations are partial, but this is exactly what has happened for us on the cross because of Christ. You avoid God and are selfish, and Jesus pays for it. You show apathy or neglect toward those in need, and Jesus pays for it. You break the commandments, Jesus pays for it. You misuse the name of God, Jesus pays for it. You abuse God's purpose for your life, and Jesus pays for it. Thomas Brooks said, you, Jesus, are nailed to your people by your everlasting love. You're nailed to your people by your everlasting love. And what he meant by that is Jesus isn't just nailed to a cross. He is nailed in sacrificial love to his people. And so as the wrath of God comes down upon sin and injustice, it is absorbed and paid for by Jesus so that we who are behind him, to whom he is nailed in everlasting love, so that we can go free. By his wounds, we are healed. And it was all planned 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born. It was all planned. Verse 6, all we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. An explanation of what we just read. Verse 7, he was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. And so the ancient prophecy speaks of a coming king who would not open his mouth like a lamb that is just led to the slaughter. This is most likely a reference to when Jesus did not defend himself initially against the accusations of the high priest in Mark 14. And it was all planned, even that, 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born. Verse 8, by oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? Stricken for the transgression of my people, and they made his grave with the wicked and with the rich man in his death, although he had done no violence and there was no deceit in his mouth. So the ancient prophecy says the coming king would have a grave with a rich man in his death. And we know this because of the tomb belonging to Joseph of Arimathea, who Matthew 26 says was rich. Next, the ancient prophecy about the coming king says that he would do no violence. Jesus literally turned the other cheek. Not only did he teach us to do so in Matthew 5, but he endured it leading up to his own crucifixion. It then says the ancient prophecy that the coming king would have no deceit in his mouth. And think of the beauty, power, and faithfulness, and goodness, and obedience coming from the mouth of Jesus. And the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew chapters 5-7, just full of goodness and faithfulness. And it was all planned 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born. It was all planned. Verse 10, yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for guilt, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. And so the ancient prophecy says that the coming king would be crushed. Jesus went willingly to the cross, and in a sense, his hands and feet were crushed with nails, John 20. His side was crushed, in a sense, with a spear, John 19. His head was crushed with a crown of thorns, Matthew 27. Although he prayed through the tears of blood on the night before his crucifixion, he prayed, Luke 22, not my will be done, but yours. The ancient prophecy says that the coming king would be an offering for guilt. And so in John 10, Jesus indicates that he goes willingly and knowingly to do this for his people. I lay down my life for the sheep. If Jesus isn't born to die, then we actually don't live because our sins are so many and heavy that they drag us into the pits of destruction, left to our own devices. The great Puritan theologian John Owen wrote, "There is no death of sin without the death of Christ. There is no death of sin and its consequences without the death of Christ." Third, the ancient prophecy says the coming king will have his days prolonged. Now, is this not a prophecy about the resurrection? He is risen, Mark 16, we read. Talk about days prolonged evermore. And it was all planned. 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born. It was all planned. Verse 11, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. So the ancient prophecy of the coming king says that one person will make the many righteous, and this is exactly what Paul teaches in Romans 5. Through Adam, the disobedience of one, sin came to all. Through the obedience of Christ, the righteousness of one comes to all. And it was all planned 700 years before Christ was born, 2,700 years before you were born. It was all planned. Verse 12, therefore I will divide him a portion with the many. He shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death and was numbered with the transgressors, yet he bore the sin of many and makes intercession for the transgressors. And it was all planned. This is the word of the Lord. Providence is that invisible hand of God. So God guiding and directing things, even though sometimes we can't see it. Rebecca McLaughlin, in her book, No Greater Love, says, I thoroughly believe that God directs my life, but rarely does he let me see the script. Can I get an amen? But it makes you wonder why. Why? Why all the time? Why can't we see more of the script? Why the intervening time? Now, friends, ultimately, we don't know because God knows, not us. He is God. We are not God. God's job is to be God. Our job is to trust that God is God. But it makes you wonder why. Let me just offer two examples that might contribute to our understanding or appreciation of the providential power and sovereignty and wisdom of God. So let's just take a look at that situation with Jesus we just described. Isaiah prophesied, there was an intervening 700 plus years between what he said and the birth of Christ. Now in that time, exactly what Isaiah said came to pass in terms of punishment came down on the people. They were exiled to a foreign land. Their beloved temple was destroyed. And they did eventually come back to the land. But might it have been the case that because the temple was destroyed, something that they revered so much, because they had this national shame and because they had to rebuild their identity when they came back, might it have been the case that people would simply not have been ready to receive or hear from the Messiah until something like that took place? God uses sin sinlessly. Here's a second thing. Now, this is from the larger pages of history, but in that intervening time, there rose a leader named Alexander the Great. And he and his military had great conquests around the Mediterranean basin and beyond, so the Holy Land and far beyond. They spread Greek culture and Greek language. And so there became this kind of Greek called Koine Greek or Common Greek that spread all through around the Mediterranean basin, including the Holy Land. At no other time in human history could common people speak and travel great distances and actually be able to communicate to this degree with one another. So only at this point in human history was it possible that the message of Jesus could actually spread that far, that wide, so quickly. Now, none of us could see that at the time. Might it be the case that God, in his sovereignty, knows what he's doing and is bringing together all the pieces just perfectly and so? And so think back to Joseph's words to his brothers. You meant evil against me, but God meant it for good. Now, this doesn't mean that everything that happens is good, because bad, evil, sinful things do happen. It simply means that nothing can stop God working his good purposes in the world generally and in your life specifically, because God's job is to be God, and our job is to trust that God is God. And so to close, I'd like to share some lyrics to a song written by a family friend, Ken Heron, is his name. When putting the sermon together, the lyrics of the song just popped into my mind. providence, the invisible hand of God, perhaps. I've heard it many times. They were family friends. He and his wife, Elaine, sang it in the church I grew up in, Knox Church. And so this week I reached out to them and I said, hey, could I use the lyrics in this? Because it just works perfectly with Isaiah 53 and Advent and everything else. And they said, absolutely. Here are the key words that come through the, sorry, next. As dark across the manger fell the shadow of a cross. Here are the lyrics. Mary watched her baby Jesus as he lay upon the hay. And her heart was filled with gladness for the gift of God that day. Yet she knew that she would lose, that God's grace would cause her pain. She was caught up in a mystery that her mind could not explain. So she stood and watched in silence. She felt gain, she felt loss, as dark across the manger fell the shadow of a cross. Joseph watched his precious Mary, and he shared with her the joy of the birth of the Messiah. It's a helpless little boy. How he wanted to protect her and to free her from her fears as she held the little Jesus and brushed away her tears. So he still and watched in silence. He felt gain, he felt loss, as dark across the manger fell the shadow of a cross. Shepherds left their flocks to see him, made their way at God's command. And they found him in the stable, but they did not understand. There was joy and celebration as he in the manger lay, but they felt anticipation, the price that he would pay. So they stood and watched in silence. They felt gain, they felt loss. As dark across the manger fell the shadow of a cross. So we gather in his presence, and we celebrate his love. Here is grace, here is glory, all the gift from God above. Help us, Father, to remember, help all the world to see that the child born in the stable paid the price to set us free. So we stand and watch in silence. Here is gain and here is loss. As dark across the manger falls the shadow of the cross. So today is a simple invitation that if God was planning very specifically for the birth and saving death of Jesus 700 years before he came to the earth, 2,700 years before you were born, is he still today doing something good behind the scenes in our world, even though we can't always see it? Is he still doing something good behind the scenes in our lives, even though we can't always see it? The answer, without a doubt, is capital Y, yes. It was all planned for good and for you, born to die, that we might live. As dark across the manger falls the shadow of the cross. Amen.